Welcome to Creative Disturbance. My name is Yvan Tina. I'm a PhD student in the Art and Program of UT Dallas. And today I have the great pleasure to be sitting with Giselle Malina and Kyle Hamilton. Can you both introduce yourself, please? Kyle?
I'm Kyle. I'm a lab coordinator here at the Art Sci Lab with interest in science and technology policy. And Giselle?
I'm Giselle Molina. I'm a third-year medical student at Loyola Stritch School of Medicine in Chicago, and I also have an interest in global health and design. We're here for the conversation today.
Okay, thank you very much. So Giselle, you were a guest lecturer in the you did a guest lecture in the outside lab earlier this week, pattern recognition, and your journey throughout medical school and different initiatives across the world related to global health and this kind of topic. So would you mind kind of like snapshot of what your talk was about, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was asked to do this talk about kind of my varied career up to this point and various ways it connected to student projects in the Art Sci Lab. And what I realized is I've done a lot of things over the years that don't necessarily seem connected, and I was trying a narrative that connected all of these things for people who didn't know me, and that could highlight these specific parts of my life that might be interesting to my audience without it appearing completely random. And I realized that in all the things that I have done, I see how they connect to each other and why they make sense in my story. But if I give those same data points of my life actions and like life activities to other people, they might see a completely different pattern, or they might not see a pattern. And it made me just think of, you know, how the story we craft about ourselves is very, very personal based off of the same data that other people see. And as a physician to be, in my 30s, trained all the time to think about patterns and stories and identity. So when a patient comes in discussing, you know, symptoms that they've experienced over the past week, and the example I gave in my lecture was a patient who came in. She had food poisoning because she'd been vomiting for 5 days. Well, she looked at her story and took out specific data points, the fact that she'd been vomiting for 5 days after eating food at a Mexican restaurant. Yeah. And her conclusion was that food poisoning. Well, I looked at that same story, the same story she gave me, and I realized that she'd been vomiting for 5 days, which is more than you traditionally get for food poisoning. Mm-hmm. She was also a kindergarten teacher, that it was flu season, that she also had the fever. So I looked at the same data points and came to a different conclusion for that same story that she gave me. And that's my job going forward as a medical student, is to have the same story, the same data that a lot of people come forward with, and to see the pattern differently and to so I was just thinking about patterns in general and the microscopic level in terms of each individual person and each individual narrative that you see, but also the narrative you give for yourself in crafting your brand, crafting the message of people.
And before talking about your medical background, you also told us last time that you've been heavily involved in Design for America, and that you've been applying your human-centered design experience in the medical field. So can you?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's correct. Before becoming a medical student, heavily involved in this organization, Design for America, which is a national nonprofit here in the United States that sets up teams of interdisciplinary college students around the country. So you'll have a theater major, a medical, like science major, an engineer, all working together on problems in their community that they're excited about trying to solve. That could be water conservation, hospital-acquired infections, literacy rates, and they use this process of human-centered design to try and solve or partially reduce those problems in their communities. And I found out about this as a freshman college student for my brother, who actually started this organization at Northwestern. And so that was the first chapter. And then I knew about this process of problem solving and looking at things around you in the world and kind of breaking them down. And and I was fascinated by it. So I started the organization at Cornell, where I was going to school. And now there's some 40 chapters or something. Much bigger. Nice. Yeah, it's a feast of its own making. But when I started it, I got really excited about the idea of kind of using that problem solving method that comes with the design of like, how can we questions that sound possible? How can we solve this is the common question that you mm-hmm. use in design. And I fell in love with it. I fell in love with that way of thinking and of being able to tackle almost any problem, no matter how little exposure I had or experience I had to a specific issue. The idea that you could learn it, that you could go talk to the people who are involved, who are experiencing it on a daily basis, and work with them to try and figure out, you know, what's a different way and a new way of tackling the issue. I went for 4 years as a student, and when I graduated, I got hired on as a full-time staff member, and my job was to mentor students around the country who were tackling problems of their own. And then eventually I got hired gig as a consultant for the American Innovation Center in Taiwan via the Fulbright scholarship. I was being an assistant to someone who got a Fulbright scholarship there, and we were teaching graduate design process. So I almost think of a separate career that I had in my early, you know, my early days, my early career formation. And I eventually went from that into medicine. But, you know, it's some people, it seems too very, but I find that I use that same process and that same way of thinking every day as a physician. But that is where I started
in terms
my
of
early
breaking down and tackling problems.
As breaking down problems, absolutely. The just general process of trying to understand a problem, like iterating multiple times when you come up with like either the problem itself, but also the ideas to solve that problem, being okay with failing and learning from those mistakes. You know, as a physician, you often, but you can do tests to figure out if this is the correct answer. And sometimes it's not, you have to keep trying and trying until you figure it out. So being okay with a rapid iterative process and also putting the human, or in my case now, the patient at the center of the issue, understand their experience of the problem, not my preconceived notions. So a lot of physicians can come into a room and like, I know exactly what a broken leg should be like. Why are you, you're not in that much pain. There's no way that this is affecting you as much. Well, there's a reason it's affecting, like if they're saying that, what else is going on in their picture? So kind of that whole way of seeing the world is interconnected as the patient or the person at the center who has valuable insight to the problem around them. There's different ways to see the problem, but that insight is still important. So that permeates every way I see the world and especially my profession. But like, so putting empathy in that person's experience at the center, and then the way of questioning okay with rapid iterations around it is something I do a lot.
So with your design and medical kind of skills and background, do you approach everything from the do you look at everything as problem-solving kind of case or situation, scenarios, I mean?
I don't think I necessarily do it. You know, I don't often go into work like, this is my problem and this is how I'm going to fix it. But when I look back at what I'm doing, I can often say, hey, you know, this, I was trying to solve a specific problem and this is the process I use the same way I typically teach design and design process. Now, you don't always have every steps. It's not ever always as clear cut. Most of the time, I don't do it explicitly, but every once in a while, I will say, hey, this is a really challenging issue. Let's do it more explicitly. For the things I see more daily or more routine, I do it without thinking about it. I do it more implicitly. It's the ones that are really tricky that I don't have an obvious answer to, where I tend to kind of fall back on the skills that I have used in the past, like break and solve challenging problems.
So now talking about your journey, so you quickly mentioned that you've been working in Taiwan, but something that doesn't appear here in the podcast, but that you mentioned during that, also been traveling quite extensively in different continents, in Latin America, Africa, and all of that. So what did you get from that experience first? And then
what's the common red thread through that?
Yeah, how do you connect all of these stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. So it comes to kind of my origin story too as well, I think. So I grew up in France. I was born and raised in France with parents who, you know, grew up in America and England and France themselves. And so I had this mixed background, and I went to the French public school system, but I spoke English at home. So I grew up in a multicultural environment, and I spent my summers in America, two countries, mm-hmm. and a lot of my friends also had kind of this mixed upbringing of different countries and different cultures.
Yeah, since you're talking about your family, let's just clarify this mm-hmm. now. So your father is Roger Molina, who happens to be a professor here at UTD.
That's correct. Yeah. So Roger Molina is my dad, and he is also a big fan of like the trying to connect all the different things I've done in my past. So he mm-hmm. thought it would be interesting to share some of these ideas. And yeah, he has a, you know, it's very much because of him and my mother that I had such a mixed upbringing mm-hmm. of, you know, Roger Molina is known for this art and science blend.
Yeah,
for Leonardo. I grew up surrounded by professionals who constantly mixed art and sciences. Mm-hmm. And it also very much came into this multicultural background of, mm-hmm. it's not just, you know, cultures and as we think of it by like country, but also in terms of cultures related to art and science, you know, mm-hmm. so I had people around me who were working on all sorts of projects from, you know, I like to bring up, there was an artist a while back who was genetically modifying out in the dark. That's correct. Yeah. And there's another one who would record trees as they grew over time and play their sounds. Mm-hmm. And this is how I grew up. And so I never made a distinction between art and science. They were a blend. It was a group.
Okay.
And so similarly, looking at different cultures and belief systems, like I see almost everything as a spectrum in those areas. It's very hard for me to divide them into silos.
Mm-hmm.
And so growing up that way, a lot of ease switching from one place to another, one language to another.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always very curious about places that I had not seen mm-hmm. and ideas that I had not been exposed to. And so when I went to college, college is a time of exploration. And, you know, I'd always wanted to go to Africa or to Asia or somewhere with different ideas and ways that I'd never been exposed to. And mm-hmm. I was lucky that I got the opportunity to do that as a freshman. I was able go down to Kenya with some other students from school. We found this orphanage there where we could stay. And I just got to live there for about a month. And then I went to South Africa for a month.
Mm-hmm.
Initial thing there was literally just to get a sense of what it meant to live in that area in Kenya or in that area in South Africa and to mm-hmm. kind of just soak in as much as I could.
Uh-huh.
But it was in those trips that I fell in love with and that in global health started to become an idea for me. Mm-hmm. And so over the years, I continued to do those kinds of trips. And so I went to Haiti after I graduated at Cornell. And
this was after the earthquake.
After the earthquake in Haiti, a few years afterwards, there's this issue where there's a lot of amputees in Haiti as a result of the earthquake. And they were suffering from chronic pain. To limb pain, where their arm or leg is no longer there, but they feel this really horrific pain in that limb that isn't there anymore. And so it's very, very difficult to treat. Medications aren't very successful because there's nothing there to treat exactly. Yeah. This treatment using a mirror called mirror therapy, where you use the reflection of the existing arm or leg and you do various therapies and techniques to treat the pain. And so I went there for a month with students from UCSD, actually, physicians and clinicians in that therapy. And I was there also translating French and English, which is helpful in Haiti. there's a lot of French there as well. I have done a lot of traveling and between the medical school, I lived in Colombia for 6 months because I went to learn Spanish. So there's a lot of different points.
At some point.
Oh, no. So I worked, Syria, yeah, I worked 2 years ago. I worked in a refugee camp in Greece, but catering to Syrian refugees who are there in Greece. So kind of over time, the overall pattern, since I was talking about pattern recognition and connecting mm-hmm. these dots, so yes, I've done a lot of traveling. It started off just to get exposure to different cultures, places.
Mm-hmm.
And then I fell in love with medicine and global health, and I realized that I loved being in these other places, and I potentially had a skill set that could be helpful, like translating for French and English.
Mm-hmm.
And so over the years, it became much more medical. These trips became more medical in nature. And so that's why I went to Haiti. And then eventually, that's why I went to this refugee camp in Greece. That's overall, like the arc there is this increasing interest in global health and in medicine. underlying just love of different cultures and languages and ideas, which kind of keeps me going to these places over the years.
And now you're studying neurosurgery.
I
but you said last time that you're not sure that this is what you want to do.
It's kind of funny. I another one of my interests throughout this, and I see this connected to my love of different ideas and ways people connect things. Mm-hmm. I think the brain is fascinating, and I can geek out about it forever. I was a psychology major in college, and when I went to medical school, I kind of wanted to continue that a little bit. But I do not, I know for a fact, I actually don't want to become a neurosurgeon. Part of it is I want a little bit more of a life than that career might allow me. Part of it is I found I really enjoyed some of the other specialties, so general surgery or emergency medicine, that allow you to have kind of a broader exposure in medicine in a specific field, and you will be doing that for a very long time. And I wanted more connections to different areas. So I think I'll likely go into general surgery or emergency medicine, but I'm continuing my research in the neuroscience department because I think it's a fascinating field. And it happened to be an opportunity where I could do that.
Do you have any question, by chance? No? No, because I could keep going on because, well, the lecture kind of pushed to reflect on the kind of opposition that could exist between global kind of enterprise and local action, which in the long term happen to be more efficient for, mm-hmm. for the local and so I was wondering if you could reflect on that and tell us what is to you the preferred method to address those specific problems that happens across the world.
Specifically related to global health or just in general the ideas of...
Specifically related to global health.
Yeah.
Why don't you spend 20 years in Haiti rather than 3 months in Haiti and 3 months in Kenya mm-hmm. and 6 months in Colombia, et cetera.
Yeah. And, you know, absolutely, you know, I had this question before and I think it's an excellent question. I think anyone going into global health or in that area should ask themselves that continuously. I think the answer changes over time. I think some people who start out place to place fall in love with a location or they realize they have a particular skill set or any sort of series of reasons decide to focus their attention one specific location and vice versa.
Yeah.
I think there are moments where an approach where you go to one place and you stay there for a long term, 20 years, mm-hmm. is absolutely the best approach for that situation.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, Paul Farmer, who's a big name in global health, has been in Haiti for years and has mm-hmm. done significant work there mm-hmm. and has done a really impressive job in increasing the amount of healthcare access for patients in Haiti, for the population in Haiti, and done a very good job at it. And, you know, if someone came there for 3 months, they would had come nowhere close to improving access to care as Partners in Health has done in Haiti.
You need the consistency.
You need the consistency. You need to build the relationships over time. Mm-hmm. You're going to need long-term funding and planning. You know, health isn't a three-month thing for them. A lot. Like if someone has cancer, it's mm-hmm. great that you're there for 3 months, but we need to plan over years.
Mm-hmm.
So there's absolutely a time when that is the best approach in that specific location in that time. But there's also moments when you have war or earthquakes or tsunamis or massive, you know, disruption.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do in that moment? How many people do you have on the ground that can help in that existing chaos?
Yeah.
And so I think there are certain instances where, you know, that short term is the best you can do. Not everyone can go to Haiti for 20 years. A lot more people who can go to Haiti for a month or 3 months, mm-hmm. and their skills are needed and are beneficial in those moments. Now, Haiti is years out from their earthquake, but they have, you know, major issues of poverty still, really struggling to get their healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone can go there for 20 years, even in that instance. Does that mean that they shouldn't go at all if they can only go for a month at a time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way I think about it is if you contribute in a real way. If you're not there just only long, like a week or 2 weeks where they train you and then by the time you figure out what's what, you leave. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Not volunteerism. But if you're able to go there for a little bit longer and you're able to contribute in a real way, share your skills, teach on the ground things that they otherwise wouldn't be able to learn as easily or mm-hmm. translate and be that extra person that during that time that you're there, translation is that much easier. I think that also plays a role. And I've known in my career that I not only enjoy going into instances of like more chaotic situations, so like working in a refugee camp where mm-hmm. there's a large amount of population in flux, but I have a skill set that is particularly good in those instances. Mm-hmm. I am able to, because I grew up in it, bridge the gap between people of different languages and mm-hmm. cultures who you know, between the doctor and the refugee who are each other. Mm-hmm. And I find that I'm very good at that for bursts of time. I find that when I become comfortable, when I get used to the system, when I know everybody and everything that's going on, that isn't as useful as some people who are really good at long-term community building. Yeah. And so that is in part why I have chosen to do small periods of time in different places. It's a mix of skill set and also just time availability on my end. But if... because, you know, I'm a student, I'm a medical student, I don't have years to dedicate to Haiti. But I'm not saying that in 10 years from now, I won't have developed much more as a manager. I won't have developed much as someone who can do that long-term planning with my skill set. And maybe when that happens, I will find a place where my skill set and the needs of the community match, and I can stay there for a longer period of time. But for now, if I just imposed my skill set, it's not... I have not found an area where the needs align for any long period of time. I stay as long as I am useful and as I can actually give. So that would be
That's a really good answer.
okay, we're going to wrap up this podcast. I don't want to conclude without asking a question related to art. Mm-hmm. So you grew up in a kind of hybrid family, mm-hmm. which has both interest in art and science. Talk about the scientific kind of background that you have related to medicine. Mm-hmm. So what roles play art in your life? Mm-hmm. I know you're a musician. Well, I've heard that somewhere.
But,
integrate art practice in your daily life.
Yeah, absolutely. So as the musician comment, just because I think I am one of I'm very terrible at music. It's like something I really struggle with. It's not an inherent talent of mine. But I picked up the violin a few years ago as an adult, and I think I love it partly because I'm so terrible at it that I really. But the progress is so visible. You know, when I do play something well, it's so rewarding. It's like, oh, I've been working on this for so long, and now it doesn't sound like a cat is dying. It actually sounds like good music. So I do play. Sometimes as a creative outlet, I wouldn't subject pretty much anybody else but myself to it. But the way I see art is kind of interesting, and it's changed over the years. I used to have a lot of interest in creative writing. I used to do a lot of short stories and poetry, which I don't do as much. I mean, every once in a while, I'll get a burst of creativity, and I'm like, oh God, I have to put this down on paper. But for the most part, I'm finding that the pattern of my life is starting to converge much more. So these separate interests, creative writing and English and paintings and music and then medicine and design and global health are all converging into one area where I'm finding I can see all of those things. So mm-hmm. there's something that the art of medicine is something that's been said before. And I think each physician finds what that meaning is for them. Mm-hmm. So for example, when I was, you rotate through surgery as a medical student, I did 4 weeks in the surgery rotation and 8 weeks, but there's a moment when you're and you have a patient who you're working for to remove their gallbladder or their appendix. There's a story of what needs to be done. You need to take out their appendix, and there's very specific ways to do that. But each can use different sutures because they like the way it looks and they think it holds better. They want this patient to be, they want them not to have an ugly scar. So they're going to do something that they have found over the years. This skill set, and there's an improvisation that comes into surgery. Every person is different, and it's something that I used to see in paintings. Like every painting is different.
Is it treating the body like material, the way that the sculptor would treat his
I mean,
ceramic, clay.
It can be, but also the reality that this is a living, breathing human who you've talked to, whose life is affected, it gives it a different, just a sculpture or a painting. But there's also like the art of conversation when you talk to these patients and you try and put yourself in the life that they're experiencing, the illness that they have, or the whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. So part of the art in the work that I do, I see the beauty in the things that I do on a daily basis. But the other thing is taking that as inspiration as well. So the stories that I hear can be heartbreaking or inspirational. These people are giving you snapshots into the most and difficult parts of their lives. And so, you know, whether it's me and my terrible violin or the occasional like painting that I do when I get home that is for no one else to see but me as a response to all these emotions that I get on a day-to-day basis, or my friends who do have sculptures in their apartments that they did as a result of a case. So I think we all find ways to bring art into the science, whether or not people realize that that's what they're doing. From the surgeon or using a specific suture because it looks nice, to the other physician who says, you know, I wrote a short story because this person's life impacted me. So I absolutely see art and everything design in what I do. And I hope to continue with that going forward.
Is that addressed at like an educational level in your program? Is that incorporated into the curriculum at all? The parallel between art and medicine?
Yeah. School is going to be a little bit different as the answer to that. And at my institution, we have had the occasional lecture where they talk about medicine as an art form, and how, you know, emotional intelligence and various skills that are also important in the typical arts are also important in medicine. I don't think it's been as explicitly said as everything you do there, you can see art in it, because I think it's people in ways. But more and more I'm hearing physicians describe medicine as an art. And I think those who have been practicing it for large periods of time see it that way. So I have had lectures where that's been brought up, the art of medicine. The question is whether where they see the art is the same place that I see the art.
What is art?
Yeah. Right. I think the fact that they bring it up as a topic is amazing and fascinating, and it kind of leaves it up to each physician to see what that may or may not be.
Thank you so much, Giselle. We're gonna have to wrap up this, but you can find more information on creativedisturbance.org.
Thanks so much.
Got a bit of overrush for-